We posited that, right, the reason that David did this, which is no explanation nor an excuse, but David seems to have, you know, wanted to know just how powerful he was. And the idea of ruling over 1.3 million people was a very, you know, intoxicating kind of a project. Even Yoav told him, don't do this. And it's extremely important to reflect on that idea, and we argued, because Sefer Shmuel is authored by Shmuel, and Shmuel, we said last week, was an unrepentant critic of the monarchy. And the idea, you know, of concluding the Sefer with this horrible mistake that David HaMelech makes, and 77,000 people die in this plague, is a strong, perhaps as strong a critique of monarchy is anything else. It's just the idea of monarchy itself. Debbie, if you could just keep it on mute unless you want to contribute to this year, okay? If you want to say something. I'm going to keep it on mute, okay? So the most important element that we discussed was the idea of Malchus being something which, you know, intrinsically... or, going to ask everybody to please try to... Okay. Okay. Again, if you want, everybody wants to be able to share, it's a wonderful thing, but please keep it on mute until you're ready to do so. Okay, so the idea of Malchus really being something, you know, which even under the best of circumstances can be extremely challenging and corrupting and even corrosive, is you know, something which is important for us to reflect on as we leave Sefer Shmuel. And again, Shmuel's sort of last will and testament, he authored Sefer Shoftim, which we talked about last week, where you have the opposite pathologies, Ish HaYashar Ben Av Yaseh, and then, you know, Shmuel, which is a very strong critique of monarchy. We'll come back, go over those psukim just a little bit, but Kilo Oschama, so Hashem says to Shmuel, Ki Osi Masu Mimloch Aleihem. But Shmuel's basic idea is that the Jewish people have a king. That king is called God. And what we don't want is, you know, for the Jewish people to adopt a kind of an Avodah Zarah in terms of Basar Vadam as their king. And that's what we posited last week. So we said we would end on a little bit of, you know, a happier note. To an extent, because insofar as I think this really is a Shmuel's like a parting blow in terms of Malchus, I think we can see elements that really are positive here in terms of David and David's character. And so that's where I want to go back. Again, this is a catastrophe, in some sense an unmitigated catastrophe. 77,000 people die. We mentioned last week that the largest plague in the Torah is 24,000 people. So you're talking about threefold, and it was brought on by no good reason whatsoever. David simply wanting to count the people was an indication of, you know, how powerful he was, which is, again, a very strong attestation to the idea of power as a corrupting influence. Okay, so with that, let's jump on in. And to some extent, we'll pick up where we, you know, left off in terms of the psukim last week. So here we are. Vayomer David al Gad, Sarli Mod, Ibn Labiyad Adonai, Ki Rabim Rachamav, Uviyad Adam Alapola. So we have David presented with three options: 7 years of famine, or 3 months of defeat at the hands of his enemies, or 3 days of plague. Now, Sam and I were both in full agreement: give me the 3 days, not the 3 months, and not the 7 years. Vayitin Hashem Davar B'Yisrael, Adever B'Yisrael, excuse me, Me'aboker, Viad Eis Moed. Okay, so God sends the Dever. 77,000 people perished. Enormous number. And as let's call it the Malach HaMaves, was approaching Yerushalayim to destroy it, God immediately regretted this idea of continuing on with the destruction. Ata heref yadecha umalach Hashem haya imgoren aravna hayavusi. And God said to the malach, stay your hand. And it just happened to be that the malach at that point was about to strike the threshing floor of Aravna Yevusi. Remember, Yerushalayim was originally a city of Yevusim until David had conquered it. So Vayomer David al Hashem birotor hamalach hamakeh ba'am Vayomer hinei anochi chatati ve'anochi heveti. Right, I am the sinner. Ve'ele hatzon me'asu. But what did the people do? Tehina yadcha bi uveveit avi. I should be the object of your wrath, not the people. Okay. Now, in terms of the language that David appeals to here, right, ve'ele hatzon me'asu, I think we come to our first very redemptive moment for David. Right, that David was chosen to be the shepherd of the people. Ve'ikacheo mimichla os tzon, the pasuk says in Tehillim, me'acharei hanaveh, he was taken from the flocks. Well, you see it very strongly here. And he understands his responsibility to the sheep, in this case the people. Eile hatzon me'as. And this to me is a perfect way of, you know, bringing Sefer Shmuel to its conclusion, in the sense of nobody ever said David was perfect, but David was always best on the rebound. He sort of rediscovers, you know, his best angels. Okay, vayavo gadol David bayom ahu vayomer lo aleh hakem la Hashem mizbeach begoren aravna yivusi. Go up and build a mizbeach right there in the threshing floor of Aravna Yevusi. Vayal David kidvar gad kasher tziva Hashem. So David listens to God. Vayashkev Aravna vayard ha-melech v'ravadav v'rim olav vayitze Aravna vayishtachavu la-melech ha-pavartza. So we're going to get a very different presentation, divrei yamim. But Aravna comes out to greet David. Vayomer Aravna, madu haba adoni ha-melech al-avdo. What are you doing here? Vayomer David, leknot me'imcha ragoran livnot mizbeach la'ashem v'teyatzar ha-magefa me'al ha'am. I'm here to build a mizbeach, to offer korbanos, and that will bring the plague to an end. Vayomer Aravna David, yikach, take it. V'yal adoni ha-melech ha-to be'nav, rei ha-bakar lo'lav, ha-morgim v'chle ha-bakar le'itim. It's all free. I'll give you the wood, I'll give you the animals. Hakol natan Aravna ha-melech la-melech. There's some discussion here. Why is Aravna called the Melech? Was he an officer amongst the Yevusi? Who was he exactly? Different opinions. Was the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, Chav Talad, says he was a Ger Toshav. Some people think he was a Ger Tzedek. Vayomer Aravna l'melech Hashem elokecha yirtzecha. And Aravna said to David, God should expiate you. Vayomer ha-melech al Aravna lo, ki kano ekne me'otcha b'mechir, v'lo ale l'Hashem elokeo lo t'chinam. I don't want to take it for free. I want to pay top dollar. Vayiken David at Agoran v'Rabakar b'chasef shkalim chamishim, and he pays 50 silver pieces. Vayiven sham David mizbeach l'Hashem. Vayal olotu shlamim vayatar Hashem la'aretz v'teyatar magefa me'al Yisrael. End of Sefer Shmuel. David offers the korbanos, and the magefa stops. So David was the cause of the magefa, but he's also the healing from the magefa. Okay, this is the presentation that we have in Sefer Shmuel. What I'd like to do now is to read Divrei Hayamim, note a few differences, and then open it up for some critical discussion. What an interesting expression. Divrei Hayamim, David saw the angel of God between heaven and earth. With his sword stretched forth against Jerusalem, and David and the elders never appeared in Sefer Shmuel, so they fall on their faces. It was my idea. Malach Hashem amar al Gad leimor le David ki ale David lakim mizbeach Hashem megoren arnana yivusi vayal David bidvar Gad. So David goes up asher diber rishem Hashem vayashuv arnan vayar to malach ve'arbat banavimo mitchabim ve'arnan dash chitim. It's interesting. Aravna here, who's called Arnan, is shown hiding with his children. Vayavo David al Arnan, so David came to Arnan, who was hiding, apparently. Vayabed Arnan, vayar David, vayitzimin agoren, vayishachu David apayim aritza. So he bows down. I guess he can't hide anymore. He's been discovered. Vayomer David al Arnan, tenali mekom hagoren. If you have navo mizbeach Hashem bechasef malei tneuli, sort of echoing what we have in Chayisara bechasef malei itneuli b'tochem lachuzat kaver. Ephron offers it for free. It's a non-Jewish person, and Avram purchases it. And here we have what appears to be a non-Jewish person offering for free. And David purchases it, insists on paying full price. V'tiatzar magifa me'olam. Vayomer Arnan al David kachlach. I don't want to do it for free. So instead of being 50, as reported in Sefer Shmuel, it's now up to 600, factor of 12. Vayivan sham David mizbeach Hashem vayal olot u'shlamim vayikra Hashem vayaneu vayesh min hashemayim u'mizbeach ola. Vayomer Hashem l'malach vayashev charbo el nidana. So the malach retracts the sword. Vayira hibirot David ki anahu Hashem begoren arnon yivusi. When David sees that God has answered him, vayizbeach sham mishkan Hashem asher asa Moshe mibar mizbeach ola vayira hiba. Bama beGivon, we're told and reminded that the Mishkan was in Givon in these days. V'lo yachol David lelecha lefanav lidrosh elokim ki nivat mibnei charev malach Hashem. David was afraid to go out to Givon. Vayomer David, and David said, end of the story in Devar Hayamim, Zehu beit Hashem elokim v'zeh mizbeach leola liYisrael. This is the place which will be the Beit Hashem, the Beis HaMikdash, and this will be the place where the Mizbeach is situated. Okay. Different presentation, Divrei Yamim, 600 silver pieces, 50 silver pieces, the Beis HaMikdash, an even more detailed exploration of the idea that David insists on paying. What's the message? Let's open it up. What's going on?
I read somewhere, Rabbi, and everybody, that all that discussion about the payment was further recordation of the, you know, Yehudim, the claim to the land, of, you know, the Jewish claim to the land. That they can't, nobody can say, you know, it's not theirs because it's rightfully paid for.
Beautiful, Sam. And then that would connect it back to Avram with the Maras HaMachpelah, right?
Right.
What'd you make of the 600 versus 50?
That also was an echo of, I think, in Chayesara. When the price fluctuated, I think, and the real price all along was the 600.
Well, there, remember, it's 400.
What?
There, it's 400. Arba Meo Shekel.
Yeah, there, but I'm saying here, the real price desired by the seller was 600. It's sort of like the negotiations that occur in that part of the land.
Okay.
It's like a shuk. I think.
Anybody else have a thought on that? The 600 versus 50?
Here. Okay, I'm back. Yeah, it's reminded me of like the marketplace. It's always existed. Especially there. What did you make of it?
Well, what's the...
difference in time period between Shmuel and Divrei Hayamim?
Describing the same event.
Right, but is it written at a different time?
Maybe. Not sure. Well, what's it? Let's do some math.
Twelve.
Good, Eva. So, you know, the Gemara has a comment about this. Gemara in Zvachim says,
I was wondering if it had something to do with months, like if you pay 50 a month.
Nice.
Representing the Shvatim.
Good. Okay, Ruthie, you hit the nail on the head. Beautiful. So that it was 50 per tribe. So now we come to the second major point then of the conclusion of Sefer Shmuel in this story. The first is that David identifies himself as a shepherd. He hasn't changed. Second point is that he senses a need both to fully purchase this. Sam, I agree with you there, right? That it can't be that the future place of the Beis HaMikdash is unquestionable territory, but that he also understands the need to do that in the name of the entire Jewish people. It can't be one tribe. It's got to be for everybody. And that's important. Okay? That's number two. Ruthie, go ahead.
Does David understand, I know the endings were different, does David understand at this point when he's told to set up a Mizbeach to Hashem that this will be the location of the Beit HaMikdash in the future? Like, clearly the ending was different, but, you know, when you talk about the buying, that seems to imply that he has that clarity at the moment that this will lay the foundation for that. Was that his understanding at the moment?
Certainly in Divrei Hayamim, it's a little bit more ambiguous than Sefer Shmuel. It's interesting that in Sefer Shmuel, Shmuel doesn't record that, but in Divrei Hayamim it is recorded, that David fully I think Sefer Shmuel is a little bit more of a critique, as indicated. But if you look in Divrei Hayamim, right, it's a much more positive note, because it's not just, as in Shmuel, Shmuel says the plague was over. In Divrei Hayamim, it's much more than that. Not only is the plague over, but the groundwork is laid for the place of the Beis HaMikdash.
Which is also, I think, what he really wanted, which is a really, like, a nice kind of reconciliation for him. Like, I mean, not that he had to deal with all that death, but, like, at least when Hashem kind of forgives him at this point, like, he couldn't build the Beis HaMikdash, but at least, you know, Hashem promised that his son would if he would follow in his ways. So at least he sees, like, a small piece of that beginning.
No doubt. And it's no surprise that that appears in Divrei Hayamim as opposed to Shmuel, because Divrei Hayamim is always much more favorable to David. So very well done. Totally in agreement. So, but even by the Sefer Shmuel standard, and we'll go right over to my mom, right, the important thing is that the place of the future Beis HaMikdash, we know, is a place associated with expiation, with forgiveness. It's the very place where God stopped the plague against the Jewish people. And if that's the place that David yearns to build, so that also reflects a level of concern for the people. Excellent. Mom.
So they leave out all the detail of the negotiation, but if you're negotiating, usually you start high and you move down to a compromise price. You know, the seller says, I'll give it to you for free, Abraham. Somewhere it says 50 and then it ends up to be 600. So who is pushing the negotiation up? Was it David who said, not only am I going to pay you 50, but I'm going to pay you that worth for each tribe? We don't know, but it's just a funny negotiation.
Right. So I should have just clarified. In Sefer Shmuel, we only have one number, which is 50. And in Divrei Hayamim, we only have one number, which is 600. So you don't get a sense of the negotiation as much in the text itself, but it's all one-sided because Aravna, who's like hiding from David, scared. It's interesting. He just wants to give it for free. He doesn't want to withhold it at all. And David is the one who's like negotiating, quote unquote, against himself. But I think he recognizes that, you know, if he's going to lay the foundations for the Beis HaMikdash, it has to be national land. Every tribe has to be represented, and it has to be b'chesef mele. Okay. So those, I think, are the two major redemptive points. David identifying once again as the Ro'eh, as a shepherd. And David representing the entire people. Now, I subtitled tonight's presentation, The Ends of Monarchy, the pun of the ends, but more importantly, you know, like the goals of monarchy. What exactly is the institution for? So, as ambivalent as Shmuel is about it, that it's a repudiation of God on some level, the best thing that we could say the king would really be able to do, apropos, you know, the Talmudic presentation, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, shalosh mitzvos nistafu Yisrael b'shas knisas on l'aretz. The Jewish people were given three mitzvos. Limdos l'melech, appoint a king. L'hachri zaro shal amalek, to fight against amalek. And livnos beis ha-bechira, to build a beis ha-mikdash. So David here, certainly in Divrei Yamin, but to a certain extent in Shmuel as well, is demonstrating that he's fulfilling this unique obligation of the king to bring the Jewish people as close as...
What was the third one? I didn't hear the third.
Amalek.
No, that was the second.
Building the Beis HaMikdash.
Okay, then what was the other one?
Appointing a king.
Okay, thanks.
Sure. So, that I think is number one. Right? So he's getting the Jewish people closer to what the king is supposed to do. I think the second point is, as we described last week, like if Shmuel's whole critique is that a king is problematic because it leads the people away from the idea of God as king. So then building the Beis HaMikdash is uniquely important. If that's the centerpiece of David's agenda as a king, to build the temple to God, to a great extent that takes the edge off, it mitigates Shmuel's critique. Because if David makes the centerpiece of his domestic policy, we need a house for God, then the concern about the king sort of taking the place of God seems to be much less urgent. Number two. Number three, when the Torah presents the idea of monarchy in Sefer Dvarim, it's a very important expression, the vilti rum levavo me'achav, that the king shouldn't be arrogant. And I think in this final section, both in Shmuel and Divrei Hayamim, we can say that David was not arrogant. Yes, he had this lapse, horrible lapse, with devastating consequences, 77,000 of them. But when he recognizes his error, he says, what did the people do? It's all my fault. Why are you taking it out on them? These are not the words of an arrogant man. These are the words of a caring leader, one who's just made a grievous error.
When Dovey said that, maybe I missed it, was the plague stopped at that time?
Not yet.
Did it have any effect?
It did. It enabled the beginning of the process of expiation, which only is complete by the time he purchases the threshing floor and builds the Mizbeach and offers the Korbanos.
Okay. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks. So, it seems to me that David is able, you know, on a personal level, to achieve a measure of redemption here. Ve'ele hatzon me'asu. Why should they be held responsible? Right. An arrogant, corrupt leader always seeks to divert responsibility. Charlotte.
Well, wasn't he given three choices? And one of them was that his enemies could, you know, follow him, just him, for 3 months. And he didn't make that choice. The choice that he made affected Klal Yisrael.
Well, why do you assume, that's an interesting point, Charlotte, why do you assume that they the enemies that would have overtaken the Jewish people would not have been able to harm the average person?
It just didn't say that.
Okay, so let me just bring the text back up so we can all look at it together. I did not have that impression, so let me just, I'm going to put it into the screen here. Second. Okay, so let me just share my screen. So 7 years of famine. So Charlotte, it strikes me that the famine would impact everybody. Or do you?
Yes.
Okay. So im number two, shlosha chadashim nuscha, you shall flee lifnei tzarecha v'hu rodfecha, in front of your enemies, and he, or whatever it is, the army, will chase after you. So you understand that to mean that just David personally.
Yes.
Interesting. So last week, I hear what you're saying. Last week we took we were taking a look at the commentary of the Radak, right? And the Radak said that part of David's motivation for, you know, choosing 3 days of Dever was that if an enemy came and attacked the Jewish people, the Jewish people would say about David, oh, well, he could just hide behind his, you know, bodyguard. It's not going to impact him. It'll only impact us. But I hear what you're saying. I think that your position is certainly defensible within the pshat, as opposed to the ra'av, which is be'artzecha, or ve'mayot shloshenimim dever be'artzecha. So, Charlotte, I definitely understand what you're saying. I think the classical interpretation is a little bit different, which would, you know, but according to your interpretation, I see why it would raise a major tension. Because if he really cared about the people, why didn't he just choose the option that was, you know, was going to protect them? Very well done. Okay. So, you know, as we bring Sefer Shmuel to its conclusion, so I think that, you know, we have kind of two things being true at the same time, even though they're clearly in tension with each other. I stand by what I said last week, which is that Shmuel is this unrepentant critic of monarchy. The fact that he chooses to end his sefer with an unforced error that David makes out of a sense of entitlement that leads to the death of 77,000 people is a manifestation of just how dangerous it is to have a king, even the best of them. But on the other hand, and I think this is, you know, an extremely important point in its own right, but just from the opposite direction, you know, David, if you're going to have a king, he might be the best man for the job because he knows how to apologize. He knows how to take responsibility. He cares about the tzon. He cares about the people. And the centerpiece of his entire agenda is to do what? To build the house for God. So Shmuel's, you know, main problem with monarchy, which is that it's, in essence, a replacement of God with a human king, that, I think, is mitigated by who David is. So if you're going to have any king, David's going to be the best man for the job. Charlotte, go ahead.
I didn't raise my hand, but...
I just saw your box popped up.
Oh, really? Oh, but, you know, it's sort of Machiavellian, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and it's a trap. So David might be the best that, you know, that we have. He certainly wrote Tehillim, and, you know, Mashiach is supposed to come from David. So there's the proof there. But
right.
It's a challenge to be a king.
And to have a king, you know, in multiple directions, right? So I think that's kind of Shmuel's, you know, final message, is that monarchy is itself highly problematic. But if you're going to have anybody, you want the one who knows how to put God at the center, number one. And number two, you know, the one you want, the one who cares about the people. And number three, you want one who can own up to mistakes. Because all of those things point in a direction that God is the only true king. Right? God doesn't make mistakes. A human being who can acknowledge mistakes knows the difference between himself and God. Think about the contrast between David and Paro, let's say, in that regard. And so in the final analysis, I think that there is kind of a defense of David here, certainly in Divrei Hayamim, but even to an extent in Sefer Shmuel, that if you're going to have this institution, a deeply problematic institution from Shmuel's point of view, you found the right person. And that person is David. Ruthie.
I have two questions, totally separate.
Sure.
One is, why when the kingship is set up in terms of David and it followed through to his son, why is there a need to set up the kingship in that way? Meaning, like, obviously we'll see that there are problems with that. Is it to, like, counteract what happened in Shoftim? Because I just feel like, why not make it available to the most qualified person, as opposed to saying, by definition, it follows in line with your family?
Yeah, and that certainly makes it more susceptible to these kinds of corruptions. I totally agree. And that I don't know that there's a logical answer to that other than that that's part of the Gzeiras HaKasa. That's part of the way the Torah sets it up. L'man yarich yamim ha-malchto huvana b'kerev Yisrael. So, you know, you could argue, Ruthie, you could argue the point. So it's definitely stipulated in the Torah. If I had to give my best, speculation, but it's nothing more than a speculation, is that when you don't have that system, it could be more meritocratic. It could also be a lot more violent. Because by definition, every generation has a succession battle.
I have one more question about what we did today.
Yeah.
When it says "Vayinachem Hashem el Hara'ah," so it says that before David actually prays, like before he says "Chatati" and "Ve'elatzon Ma'asu." Like before he says that, it says like, you know, Hashem kind of, you know, changed his mind about the evil that he was doing. So wouldn't it normally be in the other direction? Like, wouldn't first David have to actively do something and then Hashem changes his course?
Yeah, and if you look, that's one of the critical differences in between Shmuel and Divrei Hayamim, right? In Divrei Hayamim, it's David prays, and then, it's not surprising, right? More credit is given to David in Divrei Hayamim for bringing this to an end. Either way, you could probably say for Sefer Shmuel that God decided to give David the opportunity. That's the Vayinachem Hashem. And, this is kind of stating the obvious, but just at the risk of stating the obvious, all that language, Rudy, of Vayinachem Hashem and, Heref Mimeni, all of that is post-Egel HaZahav type language, right? So, we're taking us, back to, there's a plague and there's a need for expiation, so that's all there. Herb, I think you were next.
Sorry.
No problem.
Here we go. I think that Ruthie preempted my question. It was exactly that thought that went through my mind, that you indicated that, or the text indicates that God changed his mind upon seeing the angel with the sword. So did he put this into David's mind, and consequently it wasn't David's own volition that caused his change of heart, but God using David as an instrument, in effect, to end the plague?
Right. Yeah. So, and again, that's where you have the distinction in terms of the two presentations that we have in Tanakh. So, as we look forward to Sefer Melachim, I think the really interesting thing to think about is, if Sefer Shmuel is a critique of monarchy, as we've suggested, there's still a fair amount of nuance. And that nuance is that there could be better or worse kings. And David is probably the best that you could find. 50 to 600 because he recognizes the need to include all the tribes. He's not just out for himself or his family. He recognized the importance of the tzon, so to speak. Remember, that's what Moshe prayed for. V'lo ti'adas Hashem katzon asher ein lahem ro'eh. The Jewish people shouldn't be like sheep without a shepherd. And David is very much that shepherd. And when he makes mistakes, he can own up to them. He doesn't think that he's God. He doesn't need to pretend to be infallible. And then, of course, the centerpiece of his domestic agenda, quote-unquote, is the building of the Mikdash, a house for God, pointing the Jewish people in the right direction. And so I think it's, you know, it's always possible to walk and chew gum at the same time. You could be a very strident critic of monarchy and at the same time have an appreciation for who David was as a king. And I think that's exactly where Shmuel brings the Sefer to its conclusion. So God willing, where we'll start next week is with Sefer Melachim, which is, to be honest, a much more despairing kind of a work. You know, it opens with the transition between David and Shlomo, and it concludes with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. So if it opens, you know, so to speak, you know, at the very moment when the Beis HaMikdash is first being conceived, you can already appreciate the symmetry. It'll take us a long time to get there at our current pace. You know, we should finish Sefer Melachim sometime in 2025. But that's fine. It's not a race. We're trying to be thorough here. I think we have been. We've tried to be. So with that, we'll pick it up next week with the end of David's life, the transition to Shlomo, and the beginning of Sefer Melachim.
Thank you.
Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Rabbi. Thank you. Nice to see everyone.
Great to see everybody.